Blog Talk Radio.
I'm your host, Russell Price, publisher of Be There Magazine, celebrating 45 years of publishing, only in the DMV. On our newsmaker line, we have a wonderful, awesome individual, Herman Johnson. Before we bring him up, I want to thank our sponsor, CarShield, for all your car repairs. Make sure you call 866-869-4369, CarShield. Herman Johnson, you're on the air. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, thank you very much, and good morning to everybody. Well, I'm a native Washingtonian. I've lived here all my life. Joined the police, went to McKinley High School, joined the police department in 1971, retired in 94. I worked at the Washington Hospital Center at the owner donor program for 10 years. And I left there, and I went to NIH. I was an investigator out there for 10 years before I retired in 2011. So I've lived a pretty good life here in the DMV, and have a lot of friends here. And I just enjoy living here. I've traveled a lot of places. My wife and I have traveled all around the world. And it's interesting when you do a lot of traveling because you can look on television and see some of these programs. And you can see places, you know, I talked to my wife. I said, look, remember we were there and we were there and we were there, Egypt and Africa and places like that. And it's just interesting. My wife, 20 years of talking to me to get me to go to Africa. I went year before last. And believe me, if they didn't have the pandemic, I'd go back tomorrow. Very interesting place.
Wow.
Because my wife told me some things. My wife told me some things that she said, you know, when you get over there, you're going to see people that look just like somebody back here, and I swear she's absolutely right. Everybody has a twin somewhere in the world, and it's interesting to travel to those places. But
traveling makes a difference. I truly agree with you. I spent 30 years in the Air Force, and I went all around the world, and it gives you a bigger perspective of life when you can see the world. Not just looking at on TV, like you say, see the world. I mean, when you can actually see that we're living countries for 2 or 3 years, or, I mean, just being overseas in Japan and Korea and Philippines and Germany and Paris and Rome. I mean, all those things, you can look at TV and you can see it. It's a big, big, big aspect of life when you can travel. And I tell everybody, make sure you travel in life. Because
absolutely,
if you don't go nowhere, you got people, believe it or not, Herman, you got people that live in Baltimore. It's 45 minutes away, have never been to Washington, D.C. Never been to Washington, D.C. Live in Baltimore. It's the craziest day. But some people don't want to go nowhere. I mean, they really don't. They seem to think that it's okay to stay where they're at. Well, even neighborhoods and stuff like that, they just think they just live in the same neighborhood, you know. Tell us about how you got to be on the police department. What made you join the police department?
Well, my good friend who has passed on, Harold Hickman, he and I were friends since I met him in 1957, and we were friends up until his passing. Matter of fact, I was with him when he passed in the hospital, and we were just talking, and that's when they used to give the test and the trailers out on Benning Road and that was one of the places. And we were talking. He said, well, why don't we take the test, you know? And he took the test, and he passed, and then I took it, and I passed, and then I joined. I went to the 6th District out of 42nd and Benning Road, and I stayed there for 11 years in a scout car. And believe me, that is an experience in a scout car. And, well, you know, because you worked in PG County. But
right.
then I worked 3 years in narcotics, street narcotics. And when I left there, I went to homicide, and I spent 10 years in homicide. And believe me, that was one of the most rewarding jobs that I've had. A lot of tragedy, but you meet a lot of people, meet a lot of good families, and because you meet them at a bad time because they're going through something. Most of them have lost a loved one. But I have people coming up to me right now when I'm in the street or in a shopping center or something like that. Detective Johnson, I remember you when my mother died, or when my brother died, or my brother, somebody else got killed. You handled that case, and, you know, I really appreciate you did. And it makes you feel good. And it was the most rewarding for me, you know, and I knew a lot of people. And I helped a lot of people outside of my job because I was a police. You know, and people come to me now, and they'll ask my opinion on certain things. You know, and I tell them, well, things. I retired from the Metropolitan Police Department. It's been 25 years. I left in 94. And some things have changed. So I tell them that maybe you might just want to check with somebody who is currently on the police department to see if those rules and regulations are still in place. But, you know, I have no regrets for anything that I've done. I've really enjoyed my life. I've made a lot of friends. I have a lot of friends. And, you know, this year when I celebrated my birthday, I turned 80 this year. And usually, I know it's a lot of people out there. If you lived in D.C., you've probably been to one of my parties. Russell, you've been to one of the parties. And but this year, I didn't want to do anything but have my children here. And it was one of the best times that I've had. They were here with me all day long, and I really, really and truly enjoyed that.
Well, you're truly blessed to have a family and children that love you, and you have a wife that cares about you and they're with you at 80 years old. I want to tell you that's a serious thing to have. I want to ring the bell for your marriage. Tell me about how you met your wife.
Well, believe it or not, we both went to McKinley. I used to see her walking. I would see her walking across the plaza, and she was looking good, of course. And she graduated in 1959. I graduated in 1960. Well, I would run into her maybe once every 5 years or something like that. But we hooked up at the dance class over on Bladensbury Road 40 years later, and we ended up getting married about a year and a half after that. 40 years passed between her graduating and me graduating. So I tell you, and we've been married for 21 years. Got married in 2000.
You hit the relationship lottery. You hit the relationship lottery, Herman, because 40 years
ago.
Yeah,
well, you know.
And you met her, and then you met your wife, and now you've been married for 21 years, and you're 80 years old. That's an accomplishment that a lot of men don't have, and a lot of men wish they had, because as they got older, they realized that life is about living and companionship and having someone to love you back. Nothing is worth more than love of a woman, especially when you get to be 80. 80 years old, someone to wake up every morning and witness your life. I've been to some of your parties, and some of the parties that you've done, your wife has a big hand in it. She was the one who was doing most of the coordinating.
Absolutely.
And making sure, and you can see the love in the room, and everybody. Tell us about how you were able to be a homicide detective and walk into the community as a police officer, but don't have the attitude or the awesomeness thing that people look at a police officer as. They didn't look at you that way. They liked you, and knowing you were the police, I had that same type of flavor. People knew I was the police, but they didn't look at me as a bad police officer. How did you acquire that kind of attitude or that kind of outlook for yourself and was able to go into the community? You can go into the chateau and dance and talk to people, and they knew you was a police detective. What do you contribute that to?
Well, treat people like you want to be treated. That's what I always say. You know, and the way I got to homicide is that I was pretty good as a uniform officer. I made some good cases. I got awards. I have multiple awards for my job as a uniform police officer. And while I was working narcotics, Chief Isaac Fullwood told me, "Say, look, that job's not going anywhere. I want to put you down. I want you to go to homicide." So he sent me and Victor Smith and three other people down to homicide. He said, "I need somebody that can go to Southeast and walk in them alleys, and they're scared to go in those alleys." So I went down there, but let me explain something to you. I went to homicide. Everybody who wears a suit is not a homicide detective. I was down there for a while, and I said to myself, you know, maybe this ain't for you, because other people were closing cases. You don't get cases right away. You start out doing natural deaths, baby deaths, and things like that. They're important cases, but, I mean, it's nothing that you have to put somebody in a room and get them to confess. But homicide, even though I had been a police officer for multiple years, homicide, death investigation is different. It's altogether different. It's like you're starting over, because you have to learn how to do things that way. And that's what I had to do. And once I got that, I know I took a guy into the room, and sometimes it gets a little noisy in those rooms when you be talking and pounding on the desk and so forth and so on. And when I came out, one of the veteran officers told me, "Say, did you get him to confess?" I said, "Yes, I did." He said, "Now you belong in homicide." So I had been there. I had been there for a while, but I wasn't truly accepted as a detective until I was still an investigator, until I really got somebody to confess. And my partner and I, Dwayne Stanton, who we're still friends, he was over here on my birthday. My partner and I, he's younger than I am, but I learned a lot from him. And once you get into it, and we worked a lot of cases together. I know in 1989, to show you our closure rate, in 1989 I had 26 homicide cases assigned to me with 23 closed. He had 23 assigned to him with 19 closed. And this is not even including the ones that we helped other people in the office when you have multiple shootings or the big cases. So, I mean, it's a process. It's a real process, because at one time they had a shooting at 7th and S Street. There was a club right there on the corner. And I think four or five people got killed and a lot of other people got injured. What they did, there was a lot of witnesses. So the homicide detective that was in charge of that, he stopped a Metro bus and commandeered that bus and put the witnesses on that bus and took them down to homicide. And people from sex squad and robber squad and homicide squad interviewed those people till we closed that case. But, I mean, it's a lot going on. You know, just to say you're a homicide detective, you got to know what you're doing. I mean, there's a lot of people there that I don't know about now. Well, when I was there, there were some people there who didn't know what they were doing. The lieutenant told me you couldn't put them out of there because you had the unions going to raise sand. So, I mean, it takes time. You have to put in a lot of time to be what was known as a homicide detective. You start out as an investigator, then you become a detective, D2. And the reason I left is because I didn't leave on my own terms, because I was passed over for a D1, and my partner and I were doing some of the best work in investigation, in homicide. So had I taken leave, if I could have taken 2 weeks leave, I would have been good. But you can't do that, because once you get a case and you start working on that case, and then something else comes up and you work on that, and if you get another case, now that first case moves back, so you things just push back. So you have to stay on top of it. I know when I was down there, the first 3 or 4 years I was in homicide, I don't believe I took a vacation. Because when you come back, if you take a week or 2 weeks, when you come back, you're so far behind. But right. I appreciate what I did, and I think the people in D.C. appreciate what I did. You know, I sometimes sit down, my mom, she's passed, and I sometimes think about it. I say, you know, what in life have you really accomplished? And I say to myself, I think I made my mother proud. And to me, that was more important than anything else. I made my mother proud. I've been married a couple of times, and things happen, not because of me, because, you know, when you're younger back years ago, you do stupid stuff, and I'm no different. So my marriage didn't work because of me, and but now I'm older and I see things. I know people come to me and ask me things. I say, well, you know, some of these things are decisions you're gonna have to make yourself, because if you go and do what somebody else say and that's not right, then you're gonna blame them. But if you make your own decision, you have to live with it.
Absolutely right. That's what you have to do, make your own decisions. But you were a homicide detective during an era where the murders were like up in the 400s. It was called the murder capital of the D.C. was the murder capital of the world. I mean, it was crazy that D.C. was having all those killings. It was mainly black people. Today, what do you think of today, of the D.C. today, with the actual police department? And because you had the experience of being on the police department during an era where policing was totally different than it is today, totally different. And you were there doing real homicides. I mean, because you had a homicide almost every day. How do you think this is today, with the way policing is today in D.C.?
Well, let me say this. The police department now, I don't know. I used to know every chief in all the districts, all the seven districts. I knew all of them personally by their first names. And now I don't think I know anybody on the police department. The thing that surprised me now is the young people. I mean, where are they shooting each other and they're getting these guns from? Well, I know where they're getting the guns from. They're buying them on the street, and when they commit these burglaries, as you know, they get a gun and they take a gun from there. But when I went to homicide in 1985, the total death rate of homicides the year before was 280. And the whole 10 years I was down there, we were over 500 every year. And I mean, it was so bad. I actually got two homicide cases in 1 year. They've had one killing at the Smithsonian Institute. That was my case. I solved that case all night long. I went down there at 7 o'clock in the morning, and I didn't leave the crime scene until 3:30 that afternoon. And I mean, I've had some high profile cases. I've had some high profile people who lost their lives that I handled their death. And it's just a thing. I mean, I remember my first homicide, Victor Smith, and I. We went. They had seven homicides that night, six homicides that night, and the captain sent me and Victor Smith to the medical examiners to do autopsy. My first time there. I did six autopsies. Six the first time. And they had one left over from the day before. I mean, they were killing people so fast then. And it was just a thing that you had to get used to. I think it was 89. It's in January, 88 or 89. It's 31 days in the month of January. We had 32 homicides that month. 32 in January. Starting the first of the year. We had one killing behind the old post office, which is now Trump Towers. I mean, that's the way it was then.
Well, you did a heck of a job. I mean, to come through all the things that you've done and to come out on the other side of the fence, what you have witnessed in your life, the homicides and the things that you have done, but now you're 80 years old. And you are now what they call a sound mind. You retired from the government and the police department. What was your first thought when when you woke up this morning?
Well, I got somebody coming here to the house to do some work, but, you know, you just be glad you don't have to go to work. You don't have any, I don't have any worries. I don't have any stress. You know, everything is working out just fine. I mean, I have no problems. I have no problems. I have good friends. I have good neighbors. My next door neighbor, his uncle and I worked together in 6th District at 42nd and Bennett Road for 11 years. And when he moved in 5 years ago, this whole pandemic, what I've been doing, I haven't been going out. I get my shots and things. I stay at home. He comes over. We sit outside underneath my deck, play some music, smoke cigars, drink some Tito's, and that's what I've been doing all summer long. And I've been content. You know, when you're content, when you don't have problems, when you're stressed, and you have problems, things don't work out good for you. But when you don't have problems, you know, you get in an argument with your wife. You know, things don't go good all the time the way you want them to. I just found out, somebody told me, her cousin told me, pick your battles. You know, if I think I'm wrong, I just shut up and walk away. So that's what you got to do. If you put stress on yourself, you're going to have stress in your life. So what I do is, like I said, when I wake up, I get up and I stretch in the morning. I say, it's going to be a beautiful day. I look outside. The sun is shining. And I don't have any problem. I just think, what am I going to do today? I might take some clothes to the cleaners. A few things, the shorts and things I'd be wearing, because all the other clothes that I'm wearing, I clean them. They're just hanging in the closet clean. All I wear is shorts
right,
and wearing the sweatpants.
Nowhere to go, nothing
so,
to do.
Yeah.
If you could be any age for a week, what age would that be?
You know, like I say, I think I've done everything that just about that I wanted to. I've been every place I wanted to. And when I talk about that, the most place that I cherish the most is when I went to Egypt. I went to the pyramids, and I said to myself, I walked up to him and I put my hand on him. I said, I am actually here. That meant a lot to me. Same thing with Paris, the Eiffel Tower, places like that, the Leaning Tower of Pisa. I climbed up the Leaning Tower of Pisa. They got an elevator on there, but it's a small elevator, but only about 10 people. They had about 150 people waiting to go. I walked up, walked around, and when I got up to the top, I stayed up there, and I said to myself, well, it's been in this position for a long time, so it might be time for it to fall, so let me get back down. I did the same thing when I went to Egypt. I went down in the underneath of the some of the pyramids. And, I mean, it's an experience that you go down there and, hey, man, my life is good.
You have a very extremely good life. Your life is better than most people's lives. But what age you could be, if you could be what age for a week that you could be, would you be? What age would you choose to be?
I would say 30. Because, you know, a lot of things happen to you. At least to me, dear. When you turn 30, it's like jumping over a hump. So when I hit 30, a lot of things sort of changed, and I had just joined the police department just before 30, and I would say 30. It was a good age.
Good age, 30 years old. What type of music do you listen to?
I'm like Steve Harvey. I'm old school, man. I'm old school. I can enjoy any kind of music, but I'm old school. Chuck Brown was a very, very good friend of mine. I met him and his wife, and I didn't meet his kids, but when I used to work midnights out of 6th District, when Chuck would finish the job, he would stop by the Bar 20 and have breakfast. I got to know him very well, and good guy. I love Chuck Brown's music. But old school, the music from the 50s, the Coasters, the Dubs, Shepherd the Limelight, all those old music, I love it. I can hear it all day long. all day.
You like me. I like old school music. I cannot get into this new music. I mean, they're making millions of dollars with it. People are making a lot of money. But by you being the age that we are, we grew up with a certain type of music. And that music is what people really, really gravitate to, because you could hear a song that reminds you of what you were years ago. And it gives you the opportunity to enjoy or have memories of things. And we had real music back then. We didn't have all this fake type music. We had real music back then. And people realized that those songs were embedded in your mind, and you could really, really, just enjoy the Smokey Robinson or the Miracles or the Temptations. People like that was really, really fantastic. I mean, the music was really something to behold. So I agree with you, old school.
I used to go to the Howard Theater, man. You could go up there, and I think for like 70, 75 cents, you could see the Coasters, you could see the Drifters, you could see so many, so three or four, you see six or seven groups for that amount of money. I mean, it was just great, man. And people, Thursday, Sunday, and Thursday. Thursday when the acts first started, Sunday, everybody went on Sunday, and Thursday the last night. Those were good times, man. Guys were standing around out in front of the Howard Theater, and it's a lot. Hopefully, it's a lot of people who listening now remember those times. I mean, you know, if you got married with somebody, hey, man, y'all would fight. If you lost, y'all might fight again. But then after that, y'all been friends. You didn't go get a gun like when I was at Homicide. You go get a gun and you settle it with a gun. And these young people,
you didn't do that.
I mean, all over the nation, man. Or killing people.
Crazy what it is today.
And these people, these men that are killing their families, and then they're cowards. What do they do? They kill themselves. Why don't you kill yourself first?
Why you gotta kill your family and then kill yourself?
Why not kill yourself first?
That's a good point. Why not kill yourself first?
Yeah. If you can't stand being with these people, you know, it's terrible, man. Every day you look at the news, or if you look on your phone, on Facebook, or some of these other websites, it's tragic. It's really, really tragic. And the younger people, I just don't understand what they're doing. The carjacking here in D.C., the young people, you're not safe anyplace. People are sitting at home watching television, and two fools start shooting in the street, or multiple people start shooting in the street. Bullets come through and shoot somebody in the head. They're inside their house, minding their business, doing what's right, and they have to suffer for it.
Absolutely correct. What's the one thing you wish you had known when you began your career?
On the police department?
Any career, the police department, your government career, what's the one thing that you wish you had known when you began?
Well, like I say, on the police department, yeah, you can know a lot, but experience. I wish I had more experience when I first got there, because let me give you an example of the experience that I had. I've been on the street in a scout car for some years ago, and a lady called about a fight. So I go up there, 90 degrees. I go up there, up in the 6th District. And these two guys in the street fighting. So I get out of my scout car, walk, and I stand in front of the scout car. So the lady come out the house. These guys are fighting. The lady come out the house. She said, well, I'm the one that called. Aren't you going to stop them? I said, no, ma'am. She said, why? I said, first of all, they're too fresh. I said, if I try to stop them, they're going to get mad at me, and both of them going to jump on me. And when both of them jump on me, it's going to maybe have me revert to using my revolver. And the first thing you're going to do is say he didn't have to shoot them. But now once they started fighting and they looked over and they saw me, I told them, I say, continue. The loser is going to jail. They both went two different directions. So without me having to do a thing, you know, I broke up a fight. But had I gone there, they're fresh, they're young. I'm trying to break them up. I'm by myself. They're going to jump on me. But I had enough experience to settle a situation without doing anything but just talking to them. So experience. Once you get on the, I mean, you get on the police department, if you haven't worked law enforcement or security or something like that, I shouldn't say security, but you need experience. You don't know what you're doing. You're walking through a dark hallway, and you can't see, but you have to learn how to feel your way. So I say experience.
Who are the three people who have been the most influential to you?
Isaac Fullwood, Mr. Coleman, Nut at the Chateau, and my mom.
Excellent. You mentioned Nut from the Chateau. How was he influential in your life? Because he was a very unique individual with that chateau and the things that he's done in the community. But how was he influential in your life?
I used to go by, if I saw her call, I would sit and we would talk. And he would explain things, and he would tell me things, and he would tell me things about life, you know, that were essential for you to know. And it was good to have those talks with him. I mean, back in the day, I was born in 1941. So you had people, older people that would talk to you. I found in my life, an older person has never told me anything wrong. They would tell you, you might not want to hear it at the time that they tell you, but you find out that they are absolutely right. And that was one of those type of people. He would tell you, he would explain something to you, and tell you about this and tell you about that. And we talked about a little bit of everything. And he was a big influence. And Isaac Fullwood, my police career, he helped me and pointed me in the right direction. I would go down to his office and sit in his office, and he would talk to me and tell me things that I should know or, you know, because he had that experience. He was the chief of police. And when he was the 6D commander, I would go and I would talk to him. So, I mean, just experience.
And you realize a lot of people don't even remember Isaac Fullwood, and he was a very, very awesome chief of police. But today, people like Isaac Fullwood, they don't even remember him. People don't even – he doesn't come up on the radar as a – he was the police chief of D.C., the Metropolitan Police Chief. But his name
and
does
when
not
he
le- – Go ahead.
And when he left there, he was in charge of something with the prison department, with people getting out of jail or something like that. He was head of that agency too. So he was a very influential. He was very influential. When I used to ride close to his house, I would always stop and talk to him. And talking to him, I would go in his house. I would talk for 2 hours. He and I would talk to each other for 2 hours. I mean, that's the type of person he was.
Wow. And I'm quite sure you met Marion Barry, and you was had the aspect of being a police officer when he was mayor for the three times, and you were during that era of being a police officer in D.C. It was very different than it is today with the policing, because people were normally close knit, and the police department, the mayor, and the police department were very, very close. During the era of say Marion Barry or Walter Washington or the people like that back then, the police department were like one. The chief of police, everybody was like on the same accord, and it was mainly a lot of black police officers. So it was it was a black city and black police officers and black commanders.
Yeah,
police department. So it was truly a police department that knew people of color that lived in the D.C., they were able to police with a different attitude because the people that they were policing were just like them.
Yeah, well, narcotics was one of our big problems. Like you say, when we were the murder capital of the world, that was all because of narcotics. I mean, they were shooting people, walking up and shooting people in the head because you owed me $5 for a $5 bag I gave you last week and you didn't pay me on time. I mean, it was ridiculous. I mean, the way they were shooting. And now the younger people, I mean, 12, 13, 14 years old, the things they are doing with guns, I mean, it's just ridiculous. And, you know, and some of these parents, they're heartbroken because they don't know their kids out here doing all these different things. But I know, I guess that if we had that old street light thing that we used to have when I was small, you could go out and you could do what you wanted to and have a good time. But when that street light come on, you better be on this front. You know,
but that street light was the litmus test, man. The street light, your mother said, be in the house when the lights come. Don't you be in, out there when the street lights come on. That's what that was. That it kept you in check. And parents back then in the day used to really look at their children and was aware of some of the things that they were doing, and they had a hand on it. And then you had a respect for your parents. I mean, I remember I was born and raised in Philadelphia. And Philadelphia was a gang town. You know, we believed in gangs back in the day. And you had the police chief was Rizzo back then, and we used to gang war with the police chief. And, you know, I mean, nobody was shooting nobody. The police officers did not shoot you back then. They would fight you. If you were gang war in the middle of the street in Philadelphia, they would call for the police, and the police would say, how strong are they? They would say, they're 80 strong, 100 strong. They say, well, give me 200 police officers. And they'd take 200 police officers, and they come, and you wouldn't have to run from the police. You would start fighting the police. And then the police beat you up, whenever they start beating you, whatever, then you get beat up, you walk away, you leave away. A lot of times, there was no lockups. There was just a brawl in the street with the police officers and the gangs. But nobody, they didn't pull guns out and shoot the people. You know what I mean? They didn't do that. That was not that kind of situation. So it's a different day now. It's a whole different day of policing, a different day. I believe in community policing. I introduced community policing to Prince George's County. When I was a police officer in the 80s, there was no such thing as community policing. But I brought that concept into PG County. Believe me, you could talk to people. You could actually talk to people. Let me ask you another question. What's the one common myth about your profession that you would like to debunk?
Well, everybody thinks that the police officer, the police department is the way it is all across the country with the bad police. You know, they're good police. I consider myself a good police officer, you know. Hold on for 1 second. They think that all police are bad police. Everybody has had a bad experience with the police officer, especially in D.C. or all across the country. If you're black, you're going to have a bad experience, you know. But the way these officers and things they're doing things across the nation is terrible. It is, and I blame the judicial system for that because they're letting them get away with it. You know, like up in Chicago, the guy running away from the police and got police pull up, shoot him in the back. That's terrible. Down in Charlotte, the shootings in Charlotte of the black people in Charlotte. And I'm surprised because I look on Facebook, guys I rode in a scout car with for years, the things they'd be posting on there. I'm just shocked. And I say that, you know, maybe it was there all the time, but it just didn't come out. So,
you didn't have Facebook. You didn't have social media. When we were police officers, we didn't have all this social media and cameras. And so people did things, especially in Prince George's County, they had situations that police officers did, but it never was brought to the front. But it wasn't like it is today, where you go into these situations, like you say, the guy shooting somebody in the back that's running. They stopped that a long time ago in Prince George's County. You cannot shoot a fleeing felon. I mean, he's gone away from you. You can't shoot the man. For what reason would you shoot him when you can get him another day? But these people are getting away with that. They, you know, I mean, that beyond a Taylor thing. I mean, they went into the lady's house and just shot up everybody and just shot up, and they all got off. I mean, the Rodney King beating, when a police officer was right there on the videotape, and they got off. So, but today, I think with this new thing with George Floyd, police officers are not going to be able to get away with things so blatantly wrong as they did in the past. It's going to stop. It's got to,
let me tell you something. If that young lady didn't pull out her camera and film the killing of George Floyd, they might have got away with it.
Or they would have got away with it because they would have said that he was being subdued and we were trying to, you know, get him under control. And basically we didn't have no knee on him. See, they what got him in trouble was that lady saw him, she filmed it. And it was 8-9 minutes and he couldn't deny that. But if that camera was not there, they would have said, oh, we weren't on his knee that long. Oh no, we tried to subdue him, but we didn't keep him, wasn't that long. You know, and other police officers would have backed him up. That's the problem. Also, the other police officers see something wrong, don't back up the police officers doing something wrong. And that was part of my situation when I was a police officer. I came when I was almost 40 years old when I came on, so I was not in the police mode of doing things just to be doing things or try to get along.
Right.
So if I saw something that was derogatory, a police, I would pull the guy's coattail. I'd say, hey, man, yeah, I'm not doing that. They were getting a video, meet me at 8200 block Kenworth, but we're going to have some stick time in. No, I'm not coming over there to do that, you know. And then they would get back to the squad, but why'd you come? Because I'm not condoning that. You know, but you have to stand up sometime for what, you know, what you believe in as far as being a police officer. And a lot of times police officers back in the day would stick together. If somebody did something wrong, they would back them up.
Yeah.
They would write them out of it.
Right.
The sergeant would write the person out of it. You know, they'd say, oh, you was going priority with no lights on and you hit this car. And when you get there, the sergeant would say, would you have your lights on? No. Oh yes, you did. We're not going to write it like that. We're going to say you had your lights on. You know, they would do
right.
stuff like that back then.
Well, you know, I had a friend of mine worked up in the 3rd District, and he saw this white officer beating up this guy, and he told him he didn't have to do that, and he reported it. And man, the whole precinct turned on him. He was.
They turn on you. They don't like you. But see that's absolutely correct, Herman. That they don't like. But see,
That blue wall.
But what saved me was I was beyond the blue wall because I came on the police department. I was never involved in the blue wall. So when they turned against me, it was nickel dime because I didn't have any police friends. I was not going to the lodge, and it was mainly I was the only black on my squad in PG County. You know, I was the only black guy in high, but I had a life before I came on the police department. I was 40 years old when I joined. So I was a manager of a bank. I had people, not a lot of people didn't know I was a police, period. I would still go out and go to places. They didn't know I was a police officer because I was not in the blue wall. I never participated with the blue wall. So when I decided I was not going to go, go along with these things they were doing, sure, they turned against me. They didn't like me, but I went and got my boutiques and went on got my, you know, I had a whole nother life that wasn't police act. I was police when I went to work. After I got all week, I drove my cruiser back to my boutique, put my three-piece suit on, and I was not the police like that no more. You know what I'm saying? I didn't go hang out with police officers. Or, you know, you got to be – that blue wall is mean that you're around them all the time, and you're part of their system. You know what I'm saying? And one thing about the PG County Police Department, Herbie, you had private cars. You had your own car.
Yeah, but when I joined the police department, we had a lot of white officers that was coming down from Pennsylvania from those mining towns because the only job up there was the mining, and their fathers and their grandfather and their great-grandfather were dying from black lung. So this was a job. They came down here, and they were making more money than their parents were. So, I mean, this was a gravy job for them. And first of all, they weren't used to seeing a whole bunch of black people. You know, and I think the same thing is happening now. You have a lot of white officers that are scared. That's why they pull their gun. And the first thing,
they're petrified. They pull up on somebody and they can't, you know, they look at the person as a threat to them and they don't know what black people are, so they shoot first. They shoot because they don't have to shoot, but they shoot anyway and get away with it. That's the problem. They get away with it. I thought I saw a shiny object. I felt like I was in fear of my life. I felt that this
fear of my life. That's the first thing they say. Fear of my life.
Yeah, I was in fear of my life, and you can't dispute that. You know, and you go to court, you can't dispute his take on it. Well, I felt I was in fear of my life. I didn't know what he was reaching for. You know, I just felt there were so many times I pulled my gun out and I could look at the suspect and know that if a guy had a knife and he was way down away from me, he's nowhere near me. And I'm telling him, put the knife down. I don't have to shoot him that far away. You know what I'm saying? He's got the knife. He ain't coming at me like that. He's just standing there with the knife in his hand. And the more you talk to the person, and the more you can get a person to drop a knife, but to shoot the person just because he has the knife in his hand, a lot of times you ain't got to do that. You don't have to do that.
But see what they do? They see an opportunity to shoot.
Mm-hmm.
So they do.
They do. And it's terrible.
I never fired my weapon on the job, and I would get in more situations like life or death situations that I thought were life or death situations after I got off the job.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean in here in Baltimore, I mean, people do crazy things, but here you go with that experience. Then you have to stop and think, say, okay, what do I do? Do I do this right or do I do that? And, you know, you just have to make a decision. And I'm glad that I've made all the right decisions. I haven't had to shoot anybody. And when that's good. That's a good thing.
Excellent thing. I'm grateful myself that I've never had to shoot nobody. You know, pulled my gun out many days, but never had to shoot nobody. What is your biggest failure and what did you learn from it?
My biggest failure?
And what did you learn from it?
Well, I guess the things that I did in marriage to make my marriage fail, my prior marriage, you know, I think about that and I say to myself, if you learn not to do the things that you do, don't make this one. Don't lose this one because you did the same thing in the previous one. So I think it goes back to experience again. You know, things that you learned that growing up, and you never stop growing. You know, you get older, but you never stop growing. And like I said, I got people come to me and ask me, hey, man, you know, I'm so-and-so-and-so, me and my wife. I said, look, that's something you got to figure out yourself, man. I don't even want to have a say in that. But experience.
Well, you can't help nobody with their relationship issues. You can only tell them what experience relationships are. But relationships are hard. It's even harder if you don't have the information. But if you don't want to compromise and understand, and I remember I interviewed a person years ago. He was married 58 years, and I asked him. I said, "What is the secret to you being married 58 years?" And I'm thinking he's going to give me some kind of long, you know, dissertation on why he married. He said, "What is the secret sauce to you being married 58 years?" And he said, "I married the right woman." And that's what it takes, man. You have to marry the right person, the person who wants to be with you through thickness and, you know, sickness. That them vows mean something. People don't realize, Herman, when people stand in front of a pastor or a minister or just of the peace and say those vows mean something. Well, people want to take the vows and no make it mean nothing. That's what the situation is about. But I tell somebody all the time, if I meet a woman and she's been married three times and none of her husbands are dead, there's nothing she could tell me about a marriage vow because you lied to God three times. I mean, there's no way to take the back of the vows don't mean nothing to you.
That's funny.
So I'm saying to people, you know, I mean, so that's what I'm saying to you. You understood the mistakes you made, what was the failure of your first marriage, but when you got married again, you took that vow literally to mean something. You've been married 21 years now to your second wife, and it's a happy marriage. It's not, I mean, when you see you together, if you're out together or you go to one of your parties, I mean, you can tell you have a happy home, man. It's a home of happiness and love and respect. and your wife looks at you, her eyes still shimmer and glitter when she looks at you. It's a real deal Holyfield. So you can tell people how, you can't give them advice, you can't tell them what to do, but you can say, look at what I have and what I've accomplished in my marriage. And like I said, you were able to buy another house. All the accomplishments that you have together with you and your spouse, it shows that 80 years old, people, if you look at your life compared to other lives, you can see how much better your life is, and it has to do with you being married also. That's part of the accomplishments is you being married.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, it is, and like I say, now is the good time. Like I said, when I wake up in the morning and look outside, people, like back in the wintertime, they say, well, we're going to get 3 inches of snow. I don't care. I ain't going out no how. Yeah, it's going to be 97 degrees. Let it be 90. I'll be right here.
Let
now.
It be 90 degrees. What do you care?
Look, I got food. I got whiskey. I got music. I got everything I need. So, I mean, I've surrounded my stuff with everything that I need. And that's important. But now, talking about that marriage now, I mean, sometimes, you know, it gets a little wild sometimes. You're going to have those times where you don't agree on everything, and that happens. You know, once you get older, I mean, like I'm older now, you know, I say, well, maybe I just better give in on this one, this, that. Because you kind of get set in your ways, even though you're married, you get set in your ways. You want certain things done a certain way, and it doesn't happen that way. You kind of get a little perturbed about it. But, you know, it's just something that you have to get used to. And I'm in a good place right now. I really am. And you were talking about that I should write a book. I got a friend of mine told me, said, man, with all the experience you have and the things you know and the people that you've met in this town that you personally know, you know, let me tell you something. Every crook in this town, big-time crook in this town, I knew and I had respect from. And I can say that with holding my head up. Not that they, because they had enough respect for me that they didn't do things in front of me. I knew that that people were saying that they were doing this, that they were doing that, but never in front of me, never. And I appreciate
that's what I think is it was a contribute to what I knew also, and people that you knew were doing things. But they knew you was a police officer, and they knew my personality. They didn't do something right. I didn't know anything about that. Like, I know people who have gotten locked up for certain things that they were doing, and I'm saying, I didn't know this guy was doing that. He was part of, you know, people that I knew, you know, that I was doing business with, whatever. I never knew that person was doing that because they didn't do those things or discuss those things around me. Tell me how you got into cigar smoking, because you're one of the people who are still smoking a cigar. Like Steve Harvey, how did you get to be smoking a cigar?
Well, my brother-in-law, my wife's brother, every time I went up to his house, he'd give me a cigar. And then another friend of mine, Camel, we used to go to the chateau together, and my wife and I used to go over to his house every Sunday. We play cards over there. And we drank Hennessy VSOP, XO, Paradise, all the good whiskey. And when my cigar got down so small, he'd give me another one. So I just got used to it. So then I started buying my own. Now, when we moved in this house, when my brother-in-law would come over, me and him would have to go out in the garage and smoke. So we put added a room onto the house and made it a cigar room. But the fan in it is good, but I know one time I was smoking in there, and I said, Dad, this fan must not be working. Well, I was talking to a guy in the cigar club. He said, what you got to do is you got to crack your window. You got to create a draft so that smoke can go out through the fan. So once I did that, I mean, hey, I it was fine. But I smoke now. I don't smoke every day. I like to smoke when I'm driving. It relaxes me. So I order my cigars from up in Pennsylvania, get them by the box, and I called last week, and the guy told me that they were on sale, $99 a box. I said, okay, well, send me 2 boxes then, so I don't have to worry about it.
Right.
So I got about a box and a half now, and you know, I'm just I just smoke. My next door neighbor still come over. We go under the house and just enjoy ourselves. But you know, the biggest part of my life now, other than being married, is my grandkids. Man, I got two grandkids. Because my wife's talking about, we know, man, we can move. We got a place in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Well, you know, we can move down there. I said, not to leave my kids, not them grandkids here.
Wow. And, see, that's awesome,
yeah,
man. You got your grandkids.
Oh, man.
See, it's a life of pure pleasure and pure happiness. I tell you, you have lived a life of not only happiness, but pure memories and good memories, and you're looking at
absolutely
more memories to come. More memories to come. Give us your closing statements. This has been one good interview, a documentary interview. Give me your closing statements.
Well, you know, first of all, I hope everybody is taking their shots because, I mean, so many people. I mean, it looked like I'm afraid when somebody called me now, they're getting ready to tell me that somebody else has died. I would like for everybody to take their shots and this pandemic to be over. We can get back to some normalcy. I don't think we're ever going to get back to where we were. Because, I mean, and that was so nice. I mean, everything was going so good then. So I hope that, and people's, you know, sometime before you pulling these guns out and shoot people, think a little bit. You know, I know some people tell me, hey, man, I'm going to buy a gun. No, you don't want a gun. I say, because a gun will make you do something that you ordinarily wouldn't do. You got to stop and think sometime. So I would hope that people would just think a little more of their fellow man. And I don't want to sound like a poet or nothing like that, but I mean, when you get older, I guess that's your thinking. You be thinking about just not about yourself all the time. You be thinking about other people. So I just hope things get back to anywhere near normal. That would be great.
It would be awesome if we can get back to normal, man. Get back to some kind of normalcy. And I agree with you, and I want to put that back out there again. Get your shots. Don't be a fool. Get your
That's
shots.
Right.
Don't find no excuse not to get your shot, because this is serious. There's people dying every day, just like you said.
Every day,
and there's people that we know. I mean, I get a call, and there's people that I know, and I'm saying people who have had the virus, who have had the vid, you know, they've got the COVID, and they're still not really thinking that they should have a shot. I mean, it's just what is up with that? I mean, don't listen to the conspiracies. Don't listen to the hoopla, the fake news, whatever you want to call it. Get your shot, man. We want to come to be somewhere back to normal. We don't want this thing to get crazy and you can never. And then we want to have no second wave. Well, just get your shot.
Yeah.
Be smart. Get your
shot.
Get your shot.
Wear your mask. Do social distancing. Everything. Now, Washington, Maryland, Virginia, and other states, they're getting back. They're opening up a little bit more. But still, wear your mask. Now, I notice going to the movie or going to some other places where I go to, everybody have a mask on, which is good.
Which is good.
It's absolutely, yeah. Yeah. So, I just hope
this
that everybody
pleasure,
just follow the rules. You know,
you break the rules
all your life. This one you need to follow. Get your shots, wear your mask, social distance. Do the right thing.
Well, this has been a pleasure and an honor, Herman. I appreciate you joining this interview. We're celebrating 45 years of publishing. This has been the documentary, Pulling Your Eyelids Open. We truly pulled some eyelids open this morning. Tune in every morning from 10 to 11. I'm your host, Russell Price. For sponsorship, you can call me at 202-445-1131. Don't miss the 45-year celebration. Coming soon. It's going to be a big one. See you tomorrow morning.
Hey, Russell. Russell.
together.
Yeah, it's been a show. Russell. Now, just one.